My name is Jeff Marsh, and it is my privilege to serve as your worship associate today. I'm joined in welcoming you by our interim minister, Anya Johnston, Kylie Taylor, our religious education coordinator, and the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent Peace Choir. Our chalice lighting today is, we come to welcome and to be welcomed, to build bridges over the chasms that divide us into a thousand separate selves, each alone, often lonely. Let us bring our whole selves with us as we gather together this morning, seeking community, caring, and ways to contribute to a better world. Consider this wisdom from Rebecca Parker, past president of Star King's School for the Ministry.
Your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. The mind's power, the strength of the hands, the reaches of the heart, the gift of speaking, listening, imagining, seeing, waiting.
Any of these can serve to feed the hungry, bind up wounds, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, do the work of justice, or offer love.
Any of these can draw down the prison door, hoard bread, abandon the poor, obscure what is holy, comply with injustice, or withhold love.
You must answer this question. What will you do with your gifts?
Choose to bless the world. The choice will draw you into community, the endeavor shared, the heritage passed on, the companionship of struggle.
The importance of keeping faith, the life of ritual and praise, the comfort of human friendship, the company of earth, the chorus of life welcoming you.
None of us alone can save the world.
Together, that is another possibility waiting.
Let us worship together.
So let's go and give you seats and come. 100% true story to tell you today. Many years ago, the animals in the great forest decided that they wanted to start a school for their children. Until that time, it had been the responsibility of parents to teach their children and all of the skills that they needed to know, but the animals of the great forest decided that it was time that their children learned from professional teachers. So they organized a school and they hired a staff. And the teachers met and decided to provide a standardized educational curriculum to their animal students. So they adopted an activity curriculum consisting of swimming, running, flying, and climbing. All the animals, they took all the subjects because it was very important that no child be left behind. So to ensure that students were progressing satisfactorily, standardized achievement tests were administered to all students. And here's what happened. The ducks were excellent in swimming. In fact, they were better than their teachers. But some of the ducks made only passing grades in flying, and all of them were poor in running. Since they were slow in running, they had to stay after school for remedial running practice. And they had to drop swimming in order to practice running during their swimming class time. So this kept up, and all the ducks' webbed feet became very sore. And the ducks were very tired, and soon they were only average in swimming. But average was acceptable in school, so nobody worried about that except the ducks. In running, the rabbits started at the top of the class, but they did very poorly in swimming. Also, the rabbits insisted on hopping around all the time, and the teachers were concerned about their hyperactivity. So they made the rabbits walk everywhere instead of allowing them to run or hop, and the rabbits had to come early every day for special swimming classes. Many of the younger rabbits developed fur problems because they had to spend so much time in the school. In the swimming pool. The squirrels were excellent in climbing and running. In fact, the squirrels were the best students climbing the standardized tree. But they wanted to fly by first climbing to the tree, then spreading their paws and gliding to the ground, because that's the way squirrels fly. But in flying class, their teacher made them start on the ground instead of at the treetop, and the squirrels were not mastering the course material. So every day, the squirrels had therapy. A flying therapist took the squirrels into the gym and made them do front paw exercises to strengthen their muscles so that they could learn to fly the right way. The squirrels' paws hurt so much from this overexertion that some of them only got a C in climbing, and some of the squirrels failed climbing altogether. The eagles were the problem children. In climbing class, the eagles beat all the others to the top of the tree, but they insisted on using their own way to get there and were quite stubborn about it. The eagles said that clearly it was the goal that mattered and that it was quite right for eagles to get to the treetop by flying. The school psychologist diagnosed them as oppositional. A strict behavior modification plan was then developed for each eagle. We can end this story, though, guys, in one of two ways. It's sad to say some schools, communities, and churches will make squirrel children learn how to fly by flapping their paws. and punish eagles for being independent and loud about their rights to be themselves. But I'm happy to say that in some schools, communities, and perhaps right here in our church, we enjoy all children for themselves. Each squirrel is a perfectly wonderful squirrel, each rabbit a lovely rabbit, whether or not they choose to hop, skip, roll, or walk. Each eagle is allowed to be an eagle, and we encourage each duck to swim and swim and swim and not worry about learning how to run. Because when we try to make everyone the same, nobody is happy, and people can get hurt, and our very best gifts can go to waste.
The swimming rabbit just cracked me up. Does anyone remember when Jimmy Carter was attacked by a rabbit in a canoe? In community, we share our stories, and our children enter in with us, and when they leave, it's also a relief as they go to be children together, to be ducks who swim and don't have to run. But it's a delight to see them sit still for a few minutes with all of us.
This week marks one of my favorite holidays. No, it isn't Fat Tuesday, though my kids really are attached to their ponchki. I usually celebrate Lent. Now, I don't do so for the typical reasons. I was never Catholic and never particularly religious when I attended Protestant congregations. I appreciate the story of how Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, but have no knowledge of the story's veracity. I celebrate Lent so that I can give something up. Now, delayed gratification is not a difficult concept for me to grasp. It isn't for most people who've gone through med school. After high school, it took 15 years of training before I got my first real job. But Lent lets me target a simple indulgence for deprivation that I can hold off for a manageable length of time. It does not need to be forever, but it can be. If chosen well, the item will be missed early on, but will become easier to live without, and maybe something I will have to desire to forgo forever. I did this with meat and chicken over a decade ago. I did it with fish 3 years ago. I've done it with bread and chocolate, but I found out I cannot live without chocolate. Now, some devout atheists argue that even acknowledging Lent and participating in ritual is anathema. They argue it gives power to the lie that is organized religion. I don't agree. I think it is okay for us to sample the traditions of Christian religions and others, even if I don't hold the underpinnings as truth. For a ritual to take hold, it must touch something deeper that may be worth taking part in. Alain de Botton said in his TED Talk, Atheism 2.0, "It is okay to steal from religions. If you don't believe in a religion, there is nothing wrong with picking and mixing, with taking out the best sides of religion. And a thorough study of religion could give us all sorts of insights into areas of life that are not going too well. As individuals, we make choices to shed our weaknesses and build upon our strengths. Now Fat Tuesday is upon us, and it's time for me to decide what if I want to give something up. I'm not big on candy or alcohol. I don't enjoy a morning latte, and I've already evolved into veganism. But now it may be time to change my strategy to something that goes beyond myself and helps out my community or the world at large. I've been reading about Lent recently and found myself at an unexpected source, the Pope. In his Lenten message from 2015, he stressed the importance of globalization of indifference. He quotes the early mystic John Chrysostom, who wrote, "No act of virtue can be great if it is not followed by advantage for others." So no matter how much time you spend fasting, no matter how much you sleep on a hard floor and eat ashes and sigh continually, if you do no good to others, you do nothing great. And Pope Francis adds, "Whenever our interior life becomes caught up in its own interests and concerns, there is no longer room for others, no place for the poor. God's voice is no longer heard, the quiet joy of his love is no longer felt, and the desire to do good fades. Now, what personal sacrifice can I commit to that will contribute to the good of the community? I have been thinking about it, and I found that the indulgence that has been hard to pass up lately is the latest Trump Twitter feed and the outrage that follows. This has been cultivated since the campaign started. The media and the people of all political persuasions could not turn away. It touches a nerve that goes straight to the dopamine receptors of the brain, just like chocolate and even crack cocaine. But it is not healthy, and the anger alone does not encourage real change. It serves as a distraction from the real opportunities within our grasp. A barrier arises between us, and we stop talking to each other about the greater good and shared priorities. We become consumed by our position we hold on the battle line. This Lent, I am going to give up checking my newsfeed for caustic tweets to break this cycle and spend more time thinking about what small part I can do to make lasting change, how I can bridge the divide, how I can make a better future for my family and community. I don't know where it will take me, and I don't know if it will last beyond 40 days. It may take a little longer for me to find the way out of the wilderness. But I am hoping this year, my personal act of sacrifice will also be a small gift to the world.
A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned E.M. Forster and the theme underlying at least a few of his novels. I have not read them all. But the theme is only connect. On that day, I was speaking of how we are wise to connect to each other and to keep each other afloat, to stay in community by staying connected. This is still in my thoughts, of course, but today I'm also thinking of the community of influences we have inside ourselves, each uniquely formed by creative tensions that shape our identity. As a religious tradition, we've also been shaped by tensions, and if we are going to continue growing and understanding ourselves, we can start by considering the difference between a you and another you. As Unitarians and Universalists were exploring the possibility of consolidating into one religious enterprise about 60 years ago, they had some discussions about what to call themselves, or debates or fights, I'm not sure. But you can imagine, there were several ideas floating around. Oh, we should be Universalists. That's a big enough word. Well, we're really Unitarians, and we're just letting you people in, and so on. One story explains the tensions of these conversations, and the meetings were tedious and long and repetitive and occasionally heated and frustrating for everyone. At some point, a prominent Unitarian spoke up and explained how they had originally wanted to simply retain the name Unitarian because it did mean we're all together, even though that's not what it means. And they said what I just said, we'll just quietly absorb these Universalists who are running out of money. But then again, so are we. They didn't say that part. But after listening to all of this for days, they had a change of heart. Realizing that Universalism should be the first part of the name, well, the first three letters of Universalism, and the rest they could take from Unitarian, thus becoming Unitarians. It's possible the story isn't true, and it's sometimes reversed with essentially the same result, where the benevolent Universalist said, let the Unitarian part of our name go first, but just the first three letters, and then we'll all be Universalists. Well, one story we know to be true about that is that they considered dropping both Uni and the other Uni and becoming the LCA, the Liberal Church of America. What would that have been like? Would the name, would the word liberal still have the manipulative connotations that it has? I wager not. We would have been a significant presence in flaunting that word, in using that word. I often wish we had. It would have been easier to answer the phone anyway. So the potentially creative tension resulted in a somewhat bland compromise, and it's very long, and we've spent almost 60 years compensating. If you've told people that you are a Unitarian Universalist, and they're not sure what that is, and they're curious by nature, and brave enough to ask, you've probably been asked about, oh, well, what do you believe, or what are the sources, where does that come from? Sometimes we offer glib answers or long academic ones, too obtuse to make sense. There are many possible answers, so all we can hope to do is present a piece of our origin, which draws on many sources. One of the areas most difficult to explain is our relationship to Christianity. Both Unitarianism and Universalism have deep roots in Christianity. It's where we came from. It's sometimes hard to see. The merger or the consolidation of the two of us brought together two denominations, each willing and able to grow and change their way of being religious. They were changing already. Universalism originally implied universal salvation. All souls would be saved in spite of sin and imperfection. Unitarianism originally implied one God rather than the Trinity. They just lost the argument at the Council of Nicaea, and Unitarian became a pejorative. We were very fundamentalist back then. It's not in the Bible literally, so we don't believe it. We have to recognize our roots. The monotheism of Unitarianism by the late 50s had softened quite a bit, and interest in other world religions was growing. Universalists were about to upstage their universal salvation idea with truth from all places. So there was a tension between these aspects of institutional identity, and we still need creativity and patience to be able to respond meaningfully to questions such as, what do you believe? We haven't completely succeeded yet in bringing our whole selves into the collective identity of Unitarian Universalism. But much has happened in the short 23 years since I entered seminary. Consolidating a strong and stubborn group of rational Unitarians with a strong and stubborn group of persistently loving Universalists was bound to create confusion. An old quip tells of someone trying to explain the difference between the one you and the other, and says that Universalists believe that God is too good to damn anyone, while Universalists believe they are too good to be damned. It's clever, though not particularly kind, nor accurate. Well, maybe a little bit accurate. Isn't there a bit of a similar tension in what we each believe, though, inside? The gift and the burden of being without a creed or a dogma to follow is that we can't say we've arrived. We can't say we've got all the answers. We can't say we've signed on to the same thing everyone else signed on to. If we face that reality creatively, though, it's almost entirely a gift. Signing on to a creed does not allow for us to bring our whole selves into the world. We would only be able to bring what aligns correctly with the creed, and we stuff away the rest. Instead, as Unitarian Universalists, we get to be and need to be evolving as new information comes to light. As we learn more, we are able to adapt and grow. It's not easy, but it is how we bring our whole selves into the conversation and into the world. Theologian Howard Thurman speaks to the effort needed to remain current in our self-awareness, what is inside of us, in this passage called The Self-Encounter. He writes, "When have you had a good session with yourself, or have you ever had it out with you? Most often you are brought face to face with yourself only when such an encounter is forced upon you. Usually it is in connection with a crisis situation, There's a death in the immediate circle of close family or friends, with the result that definite changes must be made in your way of living and thinking. You must accustom yourself to living without the active relationships of the departed one. Or it may be that there is quickening discovery that your parents are old and can no longer relate to you at the point of your needs, but you must relate to them at the point of their need. Whatever may be the occasion, there comes a deep necessity which leads you finally into the closet with yourself. It is here that you raise the real questions about yourself. The leading one is, what is it, after all, that I amount to ultimately? Such a question cuts through all that is superficial and trivial in life to the very nerve center of yourself. And this is a religious question because it deals with the total meaning of life at its heart. At such a moment and at such a time, you must discover for yourself what is the true basis of your self-respect. Thurman goes on to assert, this is found only in relation to God, whose presence makes itself known in the most lucid moments of self-awareness. And I'll paraphrase the sentence that ends this passage. For all of us come from a place beyond the mundane, discovered in the honest and total knowledge of the self. There's a wonderful and creative tension in this thought wherever you find your beliefs, whether your faith is centered on the human or the divine. Call this thing God if that works for you, or call it something else, or recognize it as ineffable. But note at the same time that it is understood inside yourself. Your understanding is inherently human. As human beings, we are subject to human frailties. More importantly, we have available significant human strengths, particularly in community, but most of all when we bring our whole self into community, because we are wonderful and amazing creatures. Now, E.M. Forster's character, Margaret, comments on connection, and she really is speaking of the same self-awareness and the attempts to bring our whole selves. I shared this part before that just says, only connect. That was the whole of her sermon. Only connect the promise, the prose, and the passion, and both will be exalted, and human love will be seen at its highest. Live in fragments no longer. Only connect, and the beast and the monk, robbed of the isolation that is life to either, will die. Now, the context, the fuller context, tells us that she is contemplating the inner being we each have as a core piece of our identity. Modified only slightly to better align with language in this century, this is what comes before that only connect. Margaret greeted her husband with peculiar tenderness on the morrow. Mature as he was, she might yet be able to help him to the building of the rainbow bridge that should connect the prose in us with the passion. Without it, we are meaningless fragments, half monks, half beasts, unconnected arches that have never joined into a whole person. With it, love is born and alights on the highest curve, glowing against the gray, sober against the fire. He simply did not notice things, and there was no more to be said. He never noticed the light and shades that exist in the grayest conversation. The finger posts, the milestones, the collisions, the illimitable views. Once, on another occasion, she scolded him about it. He was puzzled, but replied with a laugh, "My motto is concentrate. I have no intention of frittering away my strength on that sort of thing." "It isn't frittering away the strength," she protested. "It's enlarging the space in which you may be strong." He answered, "You're clever, but my motto's concentrate." And he went back to that part only. Margaret sees that we can merge or consolidate the parts within us in order to be complete. I would call it integrating our internal parts to create a holistic identity. She does it in prose. Henry is certainly an intelligent character, yet he is also obtuse in this way. He's successful in the material world, and we get moments in the story when he speaks from the heart, but they're brief and never wholly complete. He would benefit from the self-encounter that Howard Thurman describes. I know I benefit when I pause to ask myself how much I'm letting myself be a rational Unitarian and how much I'm letting my universalist heart passion drive my decisions. Either one in excess is an unhealthy basis for decision-making. It's a great gift to have them both, and I need them both to bring me to my whole life. I found that the complete and balanced me is well held in middle spaces in almost every way. Whether it is the middle between Unitarian and Universalist, the middle between male and female, the middle between cautious and bold, I can't think of a binary piece of identity, any either or piece of identity that pulls me to being absolutely one or the other. From my position in the middle, I feel advantaged to be able to access all of me and to reach that side and that side. This is where my identity is least stressed, where I'm in the middle of the creative tension of my life. I can credit something else Howard Thurman wrote for helping me eventually accept this, and I recommend taking time to consider this thought. As a general guide, he wrote, "There is something in every one of you that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. It is the only true guide you will ever have." More specifically, I loved this next so much that I printed it in my ordination service in 1999. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. So this is my question for you. What makes you come alive? Here at church, what gets you jazzed about being at church and being part of community? Now, by being here, you are part of what I get jazzed about, how I come alive. If I can help you do the same, help you find a way to do more of what makes you come alive in relation to this church, or just in relation to your life, then we make this whole place come alive even more. When you find the places you fit, when you find things to do that fit your natural way of being, you make good choices because you are motivated by an internal sense of rightness. When your drive comes from such a place, you do not expect or demand recognition from others because inside you know what you are doing is what you need to be doing. Then you have the self-awareness that Thurman wrote of. You have the God awareness that Thurman wrote of. On your own, as the unique individuals we are, we matter a great deal. We can't do much to change the world on our own, but together, that's another possibility waiting. Praying that we live with abundance in our spirits, I say again, amen. Well, you're already standing. We're talking about being whole and connected. I think you can figure this out. We each have these amazing hands at the end of our bodies. It's the way we connect to the world. We touch and feel. We have great elbows, too, for those who favor that. I favor frequent hand washing, and I'll just keep saying that. Because the feel of another's hand in ours connects us, feel the pulse. Consider that these were little hands once, attached to a little person trying to figure out what to do with it. So they stuck it in their mouth and chewed on it. We've reached out to help those in need. We've reached up when we need the help. So connected by hands feels good. We're speaking of being whole in ourselves and bringing our whole self into community. We are welcome here, whoever we are. That's pretty special. Carry it into the world. Bring your friends. tell them the difference between a Unitarian and a Universalist is insignificant compared to the wholeness of a Unitarian Universalist. Go in peace and return in love.